Chapter 11. Picking up the first mimeographed sheet of the West Marin News and Views, the little twice-monthly newspaper which he put out, Paul Dietz scrutinized critically the lead item which he had written himself. Bolinas man dies of broken neck. 4 days ago, Eldon Blaine, a glasses man from Bolinas, California, visiting this part of the country on business, was found by the side of the road with his neck broken and marks indicating violence by someone unknown. Earl Colvig, chief of the West Marin Police, has begun an extensive investigation and is talking to various people who saw Blaine that night. Such was the item in its entirety, and Dietz, reading it, felt deep satisfaction. He had a good lead for this edition of his paper. A lot of people would be interested, and maybe for the next edition he could get a few more ads. His main source of income came from Andy Gill, who always advertised his tobacco and liquor, and from Fred Quinn, the pharmacist, and, of course, he had several classifieds. But it was not like the old days. Of course, the thing he had left out of his item was the fact that the Bolinas glasses man was in West Marin for no good purpose. Everyone knew that. There had even been speculation that he had come to nap there handy, but since that was mere conjecture, it could not be printed. He turned to the next item in terms of importance. Dangerfield said to be ailing. Persons attending the nightly broadcasts from the satellite report that Walt Dangerfield declared the other day that he was sick, possibly with an ulcerous or coronary condition, and needed medical attention. Much concern was exhibited by the persons at the Foresters' Hall, it was further reported. Mr. Cass Stone, who informed the News and Views of this, stated that as a last resort, his personal specialist in San Rafael would be consulted, and it was discussed, without a decision being reached, that Fred Quinn, owner of the Point Reyes Pharmacy, might journey to Army headquarters at Cheyenne to offer drugs for Dangerfield's use. The rest of the paper consisted of local items of lesser interest, who had dined with whom, who had visited what nearby town. He glanced briefly at them, made sure that the ads were printed perfectly, and then began to run off further sheets. And then, of course, there were items missing from the paper, items which could never be put into print. Hoppy Harrington terrified by 7-year-old child, for instance. Dietz chuckled, thinking of the reports he had received about the Fokie's fright, his fit right out in public. Mrs. Bonnie Keller having another affair, this time with the new school teacher, Hal Barnes. That would have made a swell item. Jack Tree, local sheep rancher, accuses unnamed persons, for the millionth time, of stealing his sheep. What else? Let's see, he thought. Famous tobacco expert Andrew Gill, visited by unknown city person, probably having to do with a merger of Gill's tobacco and liquor business and some huge city syndicate as yet unknown. At that he frowned. If Gill moved from the area, the News and Views would lose its most constant ad. That was not good at all. Maybe I ought to print that, he thought. Stir up local feeling against Gill for whatever it is he's doing. Foreign influences felt in local tobacco business. I could phrase it that way. Outside persons of questionable origin seen in area. That sort of talk. It might dissuade Gill. After all, he's a newcomer, he's sensitive. He's only been here since the emergency. He's not really one of us. Who was this sinister figure seen talking to Gill? Everyone in town was curious. No one liked it. Some said he was a Negro. Some thought it was radiation burns. A war darky, as they were called. Maybe what happened to that Bolinas glasses man will happen to him, Dietz conjectured. Because there's too many people here who don't like outside foreign influences. It's dangerous to come around here and meddle. The Eldon Blaine killing reminded him, naturally, of the Asturias one. Although the latter had been done legally, out in the open, by the Citizens' Council and jury. Still, there was in essence little difference. Both were legitimate expressions of the town's sentiments. As would be the sudden disappearance from this world of the Negro, or war darky, or whatever he was, who now hung around Gill. And it was always possible that some retaliation might be taken out on Gill as well. But Gill had powerful friends, for instance, the Kellers, and many people were dependent on his cigarettes and liquor. Both Orion Stroud and Cass Stone bought from him in huge quantity, so probably Gill was safe. But not the darky, Dietz realized. I wouldn't like to be in his shoes. He is from the city, and he doesn't realize the depth of feeling in a small community. We have integrity here, and we don't intend to see it violated. Maybe he'll have to learn the hard way. Maybe we'll have to see one more killing, a darkie killing. And in some ways, that's the best kind. Gliding down the center street of Point Reyes, Hoppy Harrington sat bolt upright in the center of his mobile as he saw a dark man familiar to him. It was a man he had known years ago, worked with at Modern TV Sales and Service. It looked like Stuart McConchie. But then the folkie realized that it was another of Bill's imitations. He felt terror to think of the power of the creature inside Edie Keller. It could do this in broad daylight? And what did he himself have to counter it? As with the voice of Jim Ferguson the other night, he had been taken in, it had fooled him, despite his own enormous abilities. "I don't know what to do," he said to himself frantically. He kept gliding on toward the dark figure. It did not vanish. Maybe, he thought, Bill knows I did that to the glasses man. Maybe he's paying me back. Children do things like that. Turning his cart down a side street, he picked up speed, escaping from the vicinity of the imitation of Stuart McConchie. "Hey!" a voice said warningly. Glancing about, Hoppy discovered that he had almost run over Dr. Stockstill. Chagrined, he slowed his mobile to a halt. "Sorry." He eyed the doctor narrowly then, thinking that here was a man he had known in the old days before the emergency. Stockstill had been a psychiatrist with an office in Berkeley, and Hoppy had seen him now and then along Shattuck Avenue. Why was he here? How had he happened to decide on West Marin as Hoppy had? Was it only coincidence? And then the Facomalus thought, maybe Stockstill is a perpetual imitation, brought into existence the day the first bomb fell on the Bay Area. That was the day Bill was conceived, wasn't it? That Bonnie Keller, he thought. It all emanates from her. All the trouble in the community. The Austerius situation, which almost wrecked us, divided us into two hostile camps. She saw to it that Austerius was killed, and actually it should have been that degenerate, that Jack Tree up there with his sheep. He's the one who should have been shot, not the former schoolteacher. That was a good man, a kindly person, the folkie thought, thinking of Mr. Austerius. And hardly anyone, except me, supported him openly at his so-called trial. To the folkie, Dr. Stockstill said tartly, "Be more careful with that mobile of yours, Hoppy, as a personal favor to me." "I said I was sorry," Hoppy answered. "What are you afraid of?" the doctor said. "Nothing," Hoppy said. "I'm afraid of nothing in the entire world." And then he remembered the incident at the Forester's Hall, how he had behaved. And it was all over town. Dr. Stockstill knew about it, even though he had not been present. "I have a phobia," he admitted on impulse. "Is that in your line, or have you given that up? It has to do with being trapped. I was trapped once in a basement, the day the first bomb fell. It saved my life, but—" he shrugged. Stockstill said, "I see." "Have you ever examined the little Keller girl?" Hoppy said. "Yes," Stockstill said. With acuity, Hoppy said, "Then you know, there's not just one child, but two. They're combined somehow. You probably know exactly how. But I don't, and I don't care. That's a funny person, that child. Or rather, she and her brother. Isn't that so?" His bitterness spilled out. "They don't look funny, so they get by. People just go on externals, don't they? Haven't you discovered that in your practice?" Stockstill said, "By and large, yes." "I heard," Hoppy said, "that according to state law, all funny minors, all children who are in any way funny, either feral or not, have to be turned over to Sacramento, to the authorities." There was no response from the doctor. Stockstill eyed him silently. "You're aiding the Kellers in breaking the law," Hoppy said. After a pause, Stockstill said, "What do you want, Hoppy?" His voice was low and steady.
"Nothing," Hoppy stammered. Just justice, I mean.
I want to see the law obeyed. Is that wrong? I keep the law. I'm registered with the U.S. Eugenics Service as a... He choked on the word. As a biological sport. That's a dreadful thing to do, but I do it. I comply. Hoppy, the doctor said quietly. What did you do to the glasses man from Bolinas? Spinning his mobile, Hoppy glided swiftly off, leaving the doctor standing there. What did I do to him? Hoppy thought. I killed him. You know that. Why do you ask? What do you care? The man was from outside this area. He didn't count, and we all know that. And June Raub says he wanted to nap me, and that's good enough for most people. It's good enough for Earl Kolvig and Orion Stroud and Cass Stone, and they run this community, along with Mrs. Tallman and the Kellers and June Raub. He knows I killed Blaine, he realized. He knows a lot about me, even though I've never let him examine me physically. He knows I can perform action at a distance. But everyone knows that. Yet, perhaps he's the only one who understands what it signifies. He's an educated man. If I see that imitation of Stuart McConchie, he thought suddenly, I will reach out and squeeze it to death. I have to. But I hope I don't see it again, he thought. I can't stand the dead. My phobia is about that. The grave. I was buried down in the grave with the part of Ferguson that was not disintegrated, and it was awful. For 2 weeks with half of a man who had consideration for me, more so than anyone else I ever knew. What would you say, Stockstill, if you had me on your analyst's couch? Would that sort of traumatic incident interest you, or have there been too many like it in the last 7 years? That Bill thing with Edie Keller lives somehow with the dead, Hoppy said to himself. Half in our world, half in the other. He laughed bitterly, thinking of the time he had imagined that he himself could contact the other world. It was quite a joke on me, he thought. I fooled myself more than anybody else. And they never knew. Stuart McConchie and the rat, Stuart sitting there munching with relish. And then he understood. That meant that Stuart survived. He had not been killed in the emergency. At least, not at first, as Ferguson had. So this, perhaps, was not an imitation that he had seen just now. Trembling, he halted his mobile and sat rapidly thinking. Does he know anything about me? He asked himself. Can he get me into any trouble? No, he decided, because in those days, what was I, just a helpless creature on a government-built cart who was glad of any job he could find, any scrap tossed to him? A lot has changed. Now I am vital to the entire West Marin area, he told himself. I am a top-notch handy. Rolling back the way he had come, he emerged once more on the main street and searched about for Stuart McConchie. Sure enough, there he was, heading in the direction of Andrew Gill's tobacco and liquor factory. The folkies started to wheel after him, and then an idea came to him. He caused McConchie to stumble. Seated within his mobile, he grinned to himself as he saw the Negro trip, half fall, then regain his footing. McConchie peered down at the pavement, scowling. Then he continued on, more slowly now, picking his way over the broken cement and around the tufts of weeds with care. The folky wheeled after him, and when he was a pace or so behind, he said, Stuart McConchie, the TV salesman who eats raw rats. As if struck, the Negro tottered. He did not turn. He simply stood, his arms extended, fingers apart. How are you enjoying the afterlife? Hoppy said. After a moment, the Negro said in a hoarse voice, Fine. He turned now. So, you got by. He looked the folky and his mobile up and down. Yes, the folky said. I did. And not by eating rats. I suppose you're the handy here, Stuart said. Yes, Hoppy said. No hands handy, Hoppy. That's me. What are you doing?
I'm in the homeostatic vermin trap business, Stuart said.
The folky giggled.
Is that so goddamn funny? Stuart said.
No, the folky said. Sorry, I'm glad you survived. Who else did?
That psychiatrist across from Modern, he's here. Stockstill. Ferguson was killed. They both were silent then.
Lighthizer was killed, Stewart said. So was Bob Rubenstein. So were Connie, the waitress, and Tony. You remember them?
Yes, the folky said, nodding.
Did you know Mr. Crody, the jeweler?
No, the folky said. Afraid not.
He was maimed, lost both arms, and was blinded. But he's alive in a government hospital in Hayward.
Why are you up here? The folky said.
On business.
Did you come to steal Andrew Gill's formula for his special deluxe gold-label cigarette?
Again the folky giggled, but he thought, it's true. Everyone who comes sneaking up here from outside has a plan to murder or steal. Look at Eldon Blaine, the glasses man. And he came from Bolinas, a much closer place. Stewart said woodenly, my business compels me to travel. I get all around Northern California. After a pause, he added, that was especially true when I had Edward, Prince of Wales. Now I have a second-rate horse to pull my car, and it takes a lot longer to get somewhere.
Listen, Hoppy said, don't tell anyone you know me from before, because if you do, I'll get very upset, do you understand? I've been a vital part of this community for many years, and I don't want anything to come along and change it. Maybe I can help you with your business, and then you can leave. How about that?
Okay, Stewart said. I'll leave as soon as I can. He studied the folky with such intensity that Hoppy felt himself squirm with self-consciousness. So you found a place for yourself, Stewart said. Good for you.
Hoppy said, I'll introduce you to Gil. That's what I'll do for you. I'm a good friend of his, naturally.
Nodding, Stewart said, fine, I'd appreciate that.
And don't you do anything, you hear?
The folky heard his voice rise shrilly. He could not control it.
Don't you nap or do any other crime, or terrible things will happen to you. Understand?
The Negro nodded somberly. But he did not appear to be frightened. He did not cringe, and the folky felt more and more apprehensive. I wish you would go, the folky thought to himself. Get out of here. Don't make trouble for me. I wish I didn't know you. I wish I didn't know anyone from outside, from before the emergency. I don't want even to think about that. I hid in the sidewalk, Stewart said suddenly. When the first big bomb fell, I got down through the grating. It was a real good shelter.
Why do you bring up that?
The folky squealed. I don't know. I thought you'd be interested.
I'm not!
The folky squealed. He clapped his manual extensors over his ears.
I don't want to hear or think any more about those times.
Well, Stewart said, plucking meditatively at his lower lip, then let's go see this Andrew Gill.
If you knew what I could do to you, the folky said, you'd be afraid. I can do...
He broke off. He had been about to mention Eldon Blaine, the glasses man.
I can move things, he said, from a long way off. It's a form of magic. I'm a magician.
Stewart said, that's not magic. His voice was toneless. We call that freak tapping. He smiled.
No, Hoppy stammered. What's that mean, freak tapping? I never heard that word, like table tapping?
Yes, but with freaks, with funny people. He's not afraid of me, Hoppy realized. It's because he knew me in the old days, when I wasn't anything. It was hopeless. The Negro was too stupid to understand that everything had changed. He was almost as he had been before, 7 years ago, when Hoppy had last seen him. He was inert, like a rock. Hoppy thought of the satellite then.
You wait, he said breathlessly to Stewart. Pretty soon even you city people will know about me. Everyone in the world will, just like they do around here. It won't be long now. I'm almost ready. Grinning tolerantly, Stewart said, "First, impress me by introducing me to the tobacco man." "You know what I could do," Hoppy said. "I could whisk Andrew Gill's formula right out of his safe or wherever he keeps it and plunk it down in your hands." "What do you say to that?" He laughed.
"Just let me meet him," Stewart repeated. "That's all I want. I'm not interested in his tobacco formula."
He looked weary. Trembling with anxiety and rage, the fokey turned his mobile in the direction of Andrew Gill's little factory and led the way. Andrew Gill glanced up from his task of rolling cigarettes to see Hoppy Harrington, whom he did not like, entering the factory with a Negro, whom he did not know. At once Gill felt uneasy. He set down his tobacco paper and rose to his feet. Beside him, at the long bench, the other rollers, his employees, continued at their work. He employed in all 8 men, and this was in the tobacco division alone. The distillery, which produced brandy, employed another 12 men, but they were north in Sonoma County. They were not local people. His was the largest commercial enterprise in West Marin, not counting the farming interests, such as Orion Stroud or Jack Tree's sheep ranch, and he sold his products all over Northern California. His cigarettes traveled, in slow stages, from one town to another, and a few, he understood, had even gotten back to the East Coast and were known there. "Yes?" he said to Hoppy. He placed himself in front of the fokey's cart, halting him at a distance from the work area. Once this had been the town's bakery. Being made of cement, it had survived the bomb blasts and made an ideal place for him. And, of course, he paid his employees almost nothing. They were glad to have jobs at any salary. Hoppy stammered,
"This man came up from Berkeley to see you, Mr. Gill. He's an important businessman, he says. Isn't that right?"
The fokey turned toward the Negro.
"That's what you said to me, isn't it?"
Holding out his hand, the Negro said to Gill,
"I represent the Hardy Homeostatic Vermin Trap Corporation of Berkeley, California. I'm here to acquaint you with an amazing proposition that could well mean tripling your profits within 6 months."
His dark eyes blazed. There was silence. Gill repressed the impulse to laugh aloud.
"I see,"
he said, nodding and putting his hands in his pockets. He assumed a serious stance.
"Very interesting, Mr.—"
He glanced questioningly at the Negro.
"Stuart McConchy," the Negro said.
They shook hands.
"My employer, Mr. Hardy," Stuart said, "has empowered me to describe to you in detail the design of a fully automated cigarette-making machine. We at Hardy Homeostatic are well aware that your cigarettes are rolled entirely in the old-fashioned way by hand."
He pointed toward the employees working in the rear of the factory.
"Such a method is 100 years out of date, Mr. Gill. You've achieved superb quality in your special deluxe gold-label cigarettes."
"Which I intend to maintain," Gill said quietly.
Mr. McConchy said,
"Our automated electronic equipment will in no way sacrifice quality for quantity. In fact—"
"Wait," Gill said. "I don't want to discuss this now." He glanced toward the fokey, who was parked close by, listening. The fokey flushed and at once spun his mobile away.
"I'm going," Hoppy said. "This doesn't interest me. Goodbye."
He wheeled through the open door of the factory out into the street. The two of them watched him go until he disappeared.
"Our handy," Gill said.
McConchy started to speak, then changed his mind, cleared his throat, and strolled a few steps away, surveying the factory and the men at their work.
"Nice place you have here, Gill. I want to state right now how much I admire your product. It's first in its field, no doubt of that."
"I haven't heard talk like that," Gill realized, "in 7 years. It was difficult to believe that it still existed in the world. So much had changed, and yet here, in this man, McConchy, it remained intact." Gill felt a glow of pleasure. It reminded him of happier times, this salesman's line of chatter. He felt amiably inclined toward the man.
"Thank you," he said, and meant it.
Perhaps the world, at last, was really beginning to regain some of its old forms, its civilities and customs and preoccupations, all that had gone into it to make it what it was. This, he thought, this talk by McConshy, it's authentic. It's a survival, not a simulation. This man has somehow managed to preserve his viewpoint, his enthusiasm, through all that has happened. He is still planning, cogitating, bullshitting. Nothing can or will stop him. He is, Gill realized, simply a good salesman. He has not let even a hydrogen war and the collapse of society dissuade him. "How about a cup of coffee?" Gill said. "I'll take a break for 10 or 15 minutes, and you can tell me more about this automated machine, or whatever it is." "Real coffee?" McConshy said, and the pleasant, optimistic mask slid for an instant from his face. He gaped at Gill with naked, eager hunger. "Sorry," Gill said. "It's a substitute, but not bad. I think you'll like it. Better than what's sold in the city at those so-called coffee stands." He went to get the pot of water. "Quite a place you have here," McConshy said, as they waited for the coffee to heat. "Very impressive and industrious."
"Thank you," Gill said.
"Coming here is a long-time dream fulfilled," McConshy went on. "It took me a week to make the trip, and I'd been thinking about it ever since I smoked my first Special Deluxe Gold label. It's..." He groped for words to express his thought. "An island of civilization in these barbaric times." Gill said, "What do you think of the country, as such, a small town like this compared to life in the city? It's very different." "I just got here," McConshy said. "I came straight to you. I didn't take time to explore. My horse needed a new right front shoe, and I left him at the first stable as you crossed the little metal bridge."
"Oh, yes," Gill said. "That belongs to Stroud. I know where you mean. His blacksmith'll do a good job."
McConshy said, "Life seems much more peaceful here. In the city, if you leave your horse... Well, a while ago I left my horse to go across the bay, and when I got back someone had eaten it. And it's things like that that make you disgusted with the city and want to move on."
"I know," Gill said, nodding in agreement. "It's brutal in the city, because there's still so many homeless and destitute people."
"I really love that horse," McConshy said, looking doleful.
"Well," Gill said, "in the country you're faced constantly with the death of animals. That's always been one of the basic unpleasant verities of rural life. When the bombs fell, thousands of animals up here were horribly injured, sheep and cattle. But that can't compare, of course, to the injury to human life down where you come from. You must have seen a good deal of human misery since E-Day."
The Negro nodded. "That and the sporting. The freaks, both as regards animals and people. Now Hoppy..."
"Hoppy isn't originally from this area," Gill said. "He showed up here after the war in response to our advertising for a handyman. I'm not from here either. I was traveling through the day the bomb fell, and I elected to remain." The coffee being ready, the two of them began to drink. Neither man spoke for a time. "What sort of vermin trap does your company make?" Gill asked presently.
"It's not a passive type," McConshy said. "Being homeostatic, that is, self-instructing, it follows, for instance, a rat, or a cat, or dog, down into the network of burrows, such as now underlie Berkeley. It pursues one rat after another, killing one and going on to the next, until it runs out of fuel, or, by chance, a rat manages to destroy it. There are a few brilliant rats, you know, mutations that are higher on the evolutionary scale, that know how to lame a hardy homeostatic vermin trap. But not many can."
"Impressive," Gill murmured.
"Now, our proposed cigarette rolling machine..."
"My friend," Gill said,
"I like you, but here's the problem. I don't have any money to buy your machine, and I don't have anything to trade you, and I don't intend to let anyone enter my business as a partner. So, what does that leave?" He smiled. "I have to continue as I am."
"Wait," McConshy said instantly.
There must be a solution. Maybe we could lease you a Hardy cigarette rolling machine in exchange for X number of cigarettes, your special deluxe gold label variety, of course, delivered each week for X number of weeks. His face glowed with animation. The Hardy Corporation, for instance, could become sole licensed distributors of your cigarette. We could represent you everywhere. Develop a systematic network of outlets up and down Northern California, instead of the haphazard system you now appear to employ. What do you say to that? Gil said. I must admit it does sound interesting. I admit that distribution has not been my cup of tea. I've thought off and on for several years about the need of getting an organization going, especially with my factory being located in a rural spot as it is. I've even thought about moving into the city, but the napping and vandalism are too great there. And I don't want to move back to the city. This is my home here. He did not say anything about Bonnie Keller. That was his real reason for remaining in West Marin. His affair with her had ended years ago, but he was more in love with her now than ever. He had watched her go from man to man, becoming more dissatisfied with each of them, and Gil believed in his own heart that someday he would get her back. And Bonnie was the mother of his daughter. He was well aware that Edie Keller was his child. "You are sure," he said suddenly, "that you didn't come up here to steal the formula for my cigarettes?" McConchy laughed. "You laugh," Gil said, "but you don't answer." "No, that's not why I'm here," the Negro said. "We're in the business of making electronic machines, not cigarettes." But, it seemed to Gil, he had an evasive look on his face, and his voice was too full of confidence, too nonchalant. All at once, Gil felt uneasy. "Or is it the rural mentality?" he asked himself. "The isolation getting the better of me. Suspicion of all newcomers, of anything strange." "I had better be careful, though," he decided. "I must not get carried away, just because this man recalls for me the good old pre-war days. I must inspect this machine with great suspicion. After all, I could have gotten Hoppy to design and build such a machine. He seems quite capable in that direction. I could have done all these things proposed to me entirely by myself." "Perhaps I am lonely," he thought. "That might be it. I am lonely for city people and their manner of thought. The country gets me down. Point Reyes with its news and views filled up with mediocre gossip and mimeographed." "Since you're just up from the city," he said aloud, "I might as well ask you, is there any interesting national or international news of late that I might not have heard? We do get the satellite, but I'm frankly tired of disc jockey talk and music, and those endless readings." They both laughed. "I know what you mean," McConchy said, sipping his coffee and nodding. "Well, let's see. I understand that an attempt is being made to produce an automobile again, somewhere around the ruins of Detroit. It's mostly made of plywood, but it does run on kerosene." "I don't know where they're going to get the kerosene," Gil said. "Before they build a car, they better get a few refineries operating again, and repair a few major roads. Oh, something else. The government plans to reopen one of the routes across the Rockies sometime this year, for the first time since the war." "That's great news," Gil said, pleased. "I didn't know that." "And the telephone companies—" "Wait," Gil said, rising. "How about a little brandy in your coffee? How long has it been since you've had a coffee royale?"
"Years," Stuart McConchy said.
"This is Gil's five-star. My own, from the Sonoma Valley." He poured from the squat bottle into McConchy's cup.
"Here's something else that might interest you." McConchy reached into his coat pocket and brought out something flat and folded.
He opened it up, spread it out, and Gil saw an envelope.
"What is it?"
Picking it up, Gil examined it without seeing anything unusual. An ordinary envelope with an address, a canceled stamp. And then he understood, and he could scarcely credit his senses. Mail service. A letter from New York.
"That's right," McConchy said. "Delivered to my boss, Mr. Hardy, all the way from the East Coast. It only took 4 weeks. The government in Cheyenne, the military people, they're responsible. It's done partly by blimp, partly by truck, partly by horse.
The last stage is on foot.
Good Lord, Gil said.
And he poured some of Gil's 5-star into his coffee, too.